We're going to go on to case number 304-1503, NLRB versus Erie Brushen Manufacturing. And good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Geslowitz?
Yes. May it please the court, my name is Irvin Geslowitz, and I represent the respondent employer, Erie Brushen Manufacturing Corp. Now, Erie is before this court because we are opposing the National Labor Relations Board's petition for enforcement of its order certifying a union as the bargaining representative of Erie's employees. The issue before this court is whether the board was correct to certify the results of an election in which the majority of the ballots cast were in favor of the union. The board overruled three objections that we raised challenging the fairness of the election. Two of the objections involved testimony regarding threats made by the union business agent, Oscar Sandoval, and the chief in-plant organizer, Clemente Isidro. The other objection...
You mean to say alleged threats, I think, because, of course, you did not prevail on that point. Even the mere fact of the making of the threats before the hearing officer, who chose to credit testimony that, indeed, either implicit, as you've stressed in your brief, or explicit threats had not been made. Certainly not just go out and slash people's tires and beat them up kinds of allegations. You simply lost on the credibility point.
On the issue of Mr. Sandoval, that is correct. On the explicit threats, there was never any addressing of the implicit threats. And on the issue of Mr. Isidro, the hearing officer did credit the testimony of Mr. Andraca.
Well, but on the issue of Mr. Isidro, which is essentially your third objection, the full board found that it simply didn't make any difference.
That's correct. That's what the full board found, which I'll address in my argument.
Yeah, I mean, you can address that, but I mean, you're fighting an uphill battle here in that these credibility determinations were certainly critical to the hearing officer's findings, and she was in a very good position to make those determinations given that all the testimony was coming in Spanish, and she was a native Spanish speaker, and I suppose for purposes of making a record, we had to do it this cumbersome way of having everything then interpreted into English and having people saying, no, you know, that's not the right interpretation, but in any event, she was certainly well positioned to do this.
She made these credibility resolutions, Your Honor, but our submission is that with respect at least to Sandoval, she never took into account his admissions on cross-examination.
But what rule of law could you offer us that would allow us in this particular case to decide to second guess on the basis of a cold transcript, a credibility determination? Where this is certainly not something we either can or should do under governing law most, if not all, of the time.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the hearing officer simply ignored his...
How do we know that? She said she didn't ignore it. Now, it's true, she doesn't actually have a particularized discussion of every last word, but there's plenty of law that also says that that doesn't have to happen. We don't require tomes from hearing officers, and when they say, I've judged the credibility, and we give them the benefit of the doubt. We say, you did.
But in this case, Mr. Sandoval admitted in his cross-examination to talking about telling the employees how they're going to block the entrances to the plant by picketing all around the plant.
Right. He draws the thing on the blackboard, which everybody agrees, every account supports that.
And it was found that he also told them to block the entrances, which in and of itself is illegal conduct. Then they would talk to people as they entered the plant, and then the effect was going to be, quote, they were going to be scared and walk away. And
right, but
the hearing officer never dealt with that.
Except in this generic way, I don't know why we have to make the assumption that she was unaware that that testimony was in the record. She plainly didn't think that it was anything like this slashing tires, beating people up stuff, which seems to have been inspired by the video the company showed the employees.
Well,
the fears of such behavior.
If you do take that into account, his testimony was only different from the employee's testimony that she discredited in the nuance of whether it was explicit or implicit.
Well, it's not a nuance. It's a big difference, I think.
Well, if you take his version and use the proper standard, which is, quote, whether it can reasonably be interpreted by the employee as a threat, not what he intended, but what would be interpreted by the employees, and certainly two employees at least interpreted it that way, then by that standard, it was an improper statement. It was a threat.
Let's talk about, well, okay, in footnote 8 of the NLRB brief, the NLRB cites language from Davlon Engineering that indicates that a union may seek to protect an election victory from a savvier challenge by giving employees an effective explanation of its fee-waiving policy. And here, again, we have the hearing officer finding that the union explained at this January 11th meeting that all initiation fees would be waived for current employees. So my question is, why wouldn't that save the election from a savar challenge?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, the objection, the savar violations that took place here were afterwards, after that.
Why does the sequence matter, though, if the union has already made it clear that the waiver's for everyone?
Well, first of all, these two employees weren't even at the meeting. There were 12 employees.
But you've argued it's such a small bargaining unit. Your whole position is that everybody knows everything. So now you think everybody doesn't know everything?
Well, I would submit that you can't let a union get off the top, get off like that when they say that, and then 2 days later, another representative goes and says the opposite. In fact, that's what happened in Sevier.
Well, it wasn't a closed meeting. Anybody who wanted to go to this meeting could go.
But the fact of the matter is, these two employees weren't there, and afterwards, what Mr. Isidro said completely contradicted that.
But
they
look,
didn't know.
If, you know, here we are. You're asking us to presume that Isidoro's promise I realize you would rather characterize it as a threat, was disseminated. Shouldn't we also presume that the union statement at the January 11th meeting was also disseminated? In other words, so, you know, two of them weren't there, but since everything's being disseminated among these very few employees, why not this?
Because, Your Honor, this, first of all, in this particular case, it's the evil that's addressed by the Supreme Court is the use of the endorsements that you did get.
But the burden of proof was on you to attack this election, and I don't see where you introduced any evidence to show that risk was realized. Onofre, for example, doesn't even hear about it until election day, when presumably some of the employees have already cast their ballots and others may or may not have, but it certainly couldn't have been part of the campaign.
Can I correct you, Your Honor? That was before the vote. It was clear in the record that Onofre...
It's that day, though. It's not like it was weeks and weeks in advance.
Making it even...
going around. No, it doesn't. I mean, the issue we're talking about now is dissemination. Does this go out amongst people? And the less time there is to disseminate, the less likely it is. And you have no evidence anyhow. Where's your burden of proof?
Well, I disagree that under Supreme Court analysis, the burden of proof on dissemination, first of all, the Supreme Court doesn't require dissemination. And secondly, if the board is going to glom on a dissemination requirement, the burden of proof shouldn't be on us. It should be on the wrongdoer.
But the burden of proof is on you to upset the election. That's where the burden of proof starts, and I think that's where it finishes. All of these details along the way are simply aspects of the way you might choose to meet that burden.
Okay, but in this case, Your Honor, your original question was, it was the day of the election. My answer to you is that in a small unit like this, where you have a small group of employees who talk to one another, what happens on the day of the election is instrumental.
But we don't have any evidence that they spoke to any other employees that day. None. No one testified. No one said, yes, they talked to me. aside, there was some discredited testimony, but I'm once again assuming that we defer to those decisions.
Again, Your Honor, focus on what the mischief is that the Supreme Court was addressing. It's the buying of an endorsement to portray falsely its support.
I understand that, but my concern is if somebody is sitting privately thinking in their head, I'm not going to have to pay a fee and other people will, it doesn't affect anybody else's vote. It only affects somebody else's vote if we have evidence that they communicated that out into the unit.
But what is it that's being communicated? The evil is what Mr. Isidro would do with the endorsement towards other employees.
We have no evidence that he did anything. We know he wanted, or there's some evidence that you're offering that he wanted to, but we have no evidence that he did a thing.
Well, again, I will return to the Supreme Court decision, and they talk about the potential.
But conduct so aggravated as to create a general atmosphere of fear and reprisal, rendering a free election impossible.
That's not the standard. The standard is reasonably tend to interfere with the election. The standard you're talking about is when there's all kinds of violence going on by bargaining unit members that aren't even agents of the union. The standard is reasonably tend to interfere. The Supreme Court never stated that these kinds of things have to be proven. And in fact, the NLRB has never stated that before. If you look at the leading NLRB case interpreting Savair, that was a decision where there was, I think, a 34-16 difference. The board never talked about how many people knew about it. In that case, they say, did it reasonably tend to interfere with the election? Now, sub silentio, they're overturning that decision, and they're not giving an explanation for why they're doing that. And this is a Supreme Court rule. It's not a board rule. I don't think if the board's going to change the rule, assuming it was its rule, it has to give explanations for it. It doesn't do it sub silentio. And when we're talking about a Supreme Court rule, the standard isn't, let's look at what the, it's a board rule and they should be able to change it. No, it's an interpretation of the Supreme Court's opinion. And my suggestion is, if you read the Supreme Court's decision closely, that's what they're talking about. And in fact, one of the cases I cited, which was a board case in 1998, that's exactly what the ALJ did in an opinion that was pro forma adopted by the board. He said it's the potential. And therefore, even though the argument was that it was isolated, he still overturned the election.
Save some time, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Young?
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court. With regard to the credibility issues, Your Honor, I'll be brief. Mr. Gesselwitz never proved, Mr. Gesselwitz never proved that the hearing officer ignored any uncontradicted testimony or that any of her credibility findings were inherently incredible. And that's basically the standard he had to come up to in this case, and he utterly failed to do that. And as Your Honor pointed out, this was a particularly challenging case because all the witnesses testified in Spanish. And I would submit that circumstances disadvantages the reader of the cold record who has to read that testimony in English. The hearing officer, being a fluent Spanish speaker, could, unlike any of us, listen to the testimony and focus on the demeanor of those witnesses as they testified.
What about the point from the board's point of view that concerns me is indeed this Savair, or Savair, however it's pronounced, issue, since we do have an inappropriate statement being made, right? We can begin
Correct.
With that. It's not permissible to say only people who vote for the union will get the waiver of dues, others will not, and to try to influence voters that way. Mr. Gesselwitz says, you know, that in a sense infect the whole election, even though we don't really know how much it got disseminated or whether anybody else was aware that Salgado and Onofre were under this impression, this erroneous impression.
But, well, I would just point to the circumstances here before addressing some of Mr. Gifford's contentions that here the authorization cards, I believe the record doesn't show how many authorization cards in total were solicited, although it does show that 12 were solicited in November, well before there's any allegation of any impermissible statement by anyone. In November, at the very first meeting, November 4th, authorization cards were signed. Some more were submitted within 2 days of that, November 6th. And those authorization cards, 12, were enough to get an election. The only other evidence with respect to the solicitation of authorization cards is the incident involving Isidro talking to Salgado and her repeating Isidro's impermissible statement to Onofre on the day of the election. The record shows that Salgado never even signed an authorization card. So one of the prongs of the Supreme Court analysis in Sevier, I submit, is not even present here, where the Supreme Court spoke of using impermissibly solicited authorization cards to build a bandwagon effect and to paint a false picture of union support.
But Mr. Gislewicz says that's a kind of crabbed reading of Sevier, and in fact the whole election process needs to be looked at, not just the launching, if you will, the authorization cards.
Well, the whole election process is always looked at, Your Honor. At the time that the Supreme Court decided Sevier, the board standard for setting aside an election or election objections was the same. That is, you must show conduct affecting the results of the election, or you can show that the conduct of the election itself was improper, that is, board agent conduct. We're not concerned with that, obviously.
Mr. Young, how do you suggest that we handle the small plant doctrine that presumes that news travels fast and far in a small plant environment? I mean, if that's the case, why would the employer have to show dissemination of the threat to charge an initiation fee to those who do not vote for the union? Does Sevier apply only in close elections?
Not only in close elections,
yeah.
Although that's one factor. I believe the board with the courts uniformly agree,
yeah,
that when you have a close election, you scrutinize more thoroughly the evidence in support of the objection. The small plants doctrine certainly wasn't invoked here.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Gislewicz argues for that, I guess, but the board in deciding that dissemination wasn't a factor was following its view of the cases in terms of that promises of benefits, inducements to vote for a party is viewed differently than threats. Threats are seen as more aggravated, and that the board will, I suppose, in those cases, presume dissemination. But certainly with regard to a promise of benefits, it does not presume dissemination, and holds that actual dissemination must be proved. And it properly puts the burden of showing dissemination on the objecting party, the party who is trying to overturn the election. And
Mr. Geslowitz says you've been at best inconsistent, though, with imposing that burden. That sometimes elections are set aside that are lopsided, and no one even thinks about dissemination as long as something improper has happened, and then other times maybe there has been some focus on it, or
no,
at least the election was closed.
I think with respect to the specific case Mr. Geslowitz is speaking of, I believe it's Zavalin, where he says that the election was lopsided. But there, the evidence showed that all the union solicitors were using the same technique. We don't have anything like that here. We have one person, Isidro, making one comment, making one solicitation of one employee, who in turn tells another employee on the day of the election about this impermissible offer. I would also contrast it with Sevier itself. In Sevier, although there's no discussion of solicitation, it's clear that it was official union policy to offer a conditional that is an impermissible waiver. The Secretary Treasurer of the union made the offer in an open meeting, and it was repeated again and again. When you have that circumstance, sure, there is, the board takes the view that, and the Supreme Court took the view, I believe, that the party has to be, takes the view of a prophylactic rule, I guess, that the party's conduct has to be controlled. But here we don't have, Isidro is certainly not Sandoval.
Do we need to decide, as everyone seems to be sort of dancing around, whether Isidro really is an agent of the union or not?
Well, the board didn't, and the board didn't think it necessary in light of the circumstances where there was, again, the limited number of employees who even knew of this alleged conditional offer. Remember, the hearing officer said she didn't think it was impermissible because it was tied to the vote, which is another circumstance. The board ignored all that or didn't pass on any of that, and rather said it's just insufficient in the circumstances that it only got out to this one employee, and she in turn only told one other employee, and then on the day of the election. Unless there are any other questions, we submit our case.
Thank you, Mr. Young. Okay, Mr. Geslowitz, 2 minutes.
Let me dispense, if I may use that word, with this supposition everyone's making that this wasn't widespread. There was testimony from other employees that the same solicitations were made to them by Mr. Isidro. The hearing officer chose.
But that was discredited, right?
She chose to discredit it, although she discredited Mr. Isidro in talking to Ms. Salgado and Ms. Onofre about the exact same thing. So in essence, these two witnesses, the additional witnesses we submitted, said the same thing.
But unless we follow your suggestion that we conduct de novo review of this record, I'm not sure what we're to do with the uncredited testimony.
Their testimony not only was Mr. Cedro not credited in this regard, and there's therefore really nothing that said that what they were saying wasn't true, but you've got the reality of this situation. It's a small plant. The small plant doctrine does apply here. And to say these witnesses were all saying how everybody knew what was going on, to say that, well, it wasn't that widespread or you haven't shown it's widespread, is really putting your head in a hole in an ostrich-like way. because the reality of the situation is this was an ethnically homogeneous workforce in a small plant in the north side of Chicago, and if you read through the record, it's obvious that everybody knew what was going on around there. And let's just, in terms of the proof that you were talking about, let's say Ms. Salgado and Ms. Onofre were leading anti-union proponents. And now, because they were bought off, the other employees who look to them for leadership see that they're not advocating the union anymore. Nobody says anything, but see that they're not advocating the union anymore. That effect could have been there, although you can't prove that that was the case. That's why the Supreme Court talked about potential. That's what they were talking about.
But that argument presumes that the law is that any impermissible promise of a benefit, as a matter of law, taints the election.
But you're doing the same thing in that question that the board is trying to do here and compare it to benefits. It's the buying of an endorsement that the Supreme Court was attacking as the evil here. And
that promise of a benefit. And your argument seems to be that as a matter of law, any impermissible promise of a benefit.
No, I'm saying that the purchase of the endorsement, they put her name on a list. Presumably he takes that list and uses it with other employees, or these employees are now neutralized. They're not going to endorse the union, the anti-union view to other people. That's the evil here. And it's, whenever you're going to have unions doing this by word of mouth, as opposed to at a meeting, it's going to be nearly impossible to prove. You will be, in effect, sub silentio, making the Savair rule ineffective. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.